Welcome to the Day Protection Made Easy podcast. Today is the 30th of Jan, and I'm joined by Kane, as always. Hi, Kane.
Hi, Kane. How are we doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah, I'm good. Yeah, we just had another Good Friday session, as always.
We today actually talked a lot about TPIAs. Actually, was our topical session. And what did you feel about the session? It was a good one, wasn't it?
Yeah, good as always. Yeah. About one of my more preferred topics. I love talking about DPIAs.
Yeah, I do. I'm a DPIA expert.
Because I think they're so detailed, and I love the nuances of it, and I love reviewing them. I love talking to people about them because I like risk. I think risk is probably one of the more interesting things about data protection as a whole. I think it was a great session as always. Yeah. Were there any particular highlights to you?
Yes, I think we kind of addressed the main topics of at least the main elements of a DPIA in the process itself. I think probably the big one for me and the most important is responsibility. Who is responsible to do the DPIAs, and as well as should we do a DPIA for every single bit of processing personal data, regardless the risk. Mm. I think that was a very good discussion. We actually had someone joining us on that episode to join on that conversation.
Yeah.
What about you?
Yeah, again, just the broader conversation about sort of the DPO's role, I guess, when we're looking at DPIAs, how they work with other parties, namely sort of vendors and process owners. You know, it's all a very interesting broad conversation, and when we're talking about the news as well, in relation to like the police and stuff,
yeah,
really, really, really intriguing. And it's always interesting to see how other organisations sort of adopt a risk-based approach, and it seems like it's not always the case that actually is happening.
Yeah.
But no, again, you know, another fantastic session as usual. Probably something that we will we'll follow up with in the coming weeks, won't we? I think.
Yeah, absolutely. But we will not say anything else. So please give us a go. Thank you.
All right. Cheers.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. I hope we're all doing well this week. Of course, if there's anybody new joining, we do apologise. We do like to start these things on little bits of tangents here and now, but really interesting to get some of your insights of some of your earlier careers. You know, that's really nice to hear.
Thank you.
So, obviously, before we kickstart into this session, obviously, we've got a really interesting session today talking about DPIAs. Just a few bits of housekeeping just before we get kicked into the session. As always, as you know, that these sessions are recorded by ourselves so we can publish them on things like Spotify and streaming websites. Hopefully Mars can bob the privacy notice onto the chat on the screen, whichever one, just to let you know that those are recorded. And again, the main sort of thing in relation to AI chatbots as normal. Of course, if we do see them, we will be removing them due to feedback from the community. And just people are super fond on them in the podcast. And just a note as well that you know, feel free to help and engage and talk in the session. Whenever, you know, we want you guys to be engaged in this is your session just as much as it is ours, if not even more so. You know, I think that's probably the main ones. Kay, are there any DPP-centric news that we have?
No, I don't think so. Just obviously next week we have the STES events on Thursday, which is quite exciting. We are actually sold out. So we have sold, gave 80 tickets already, which is quite exciting. And we are preparing ourselves to be brilliant, aren't we?
Yeah, hopefully brilliant.
Joining by Phil as well and a guest speaker.
Yeah, so, you know, if you guys like listening to us for whatever crazy reason that would be. And if you are coming on Thursday, please come and say hello. You know, we absolutely love to talk to you guys, whether you're customers or you're not. So before the event, come say hello. We've got a couple of breaks spotted in between as well. So we'd love to have a chat with you.
Yeah, I think it would be brilliant. Like, actually, it's just to networking as well. And it actually to finally put some faces in the names, isn't it? Because I think even like consultancy less than support, but I think in support you do deal a lot with a lot of cases and emails and stuff. But sometimes you were not able to see the person ever. But then does it not happen to you when you have actually a name, but then you would never thought the person would look like that?
I always,
you know,
like I always try my best to like sort of picture it.
Yeah,
and people must always get the idea of who I am wrong, because I always get loads of different names that aren't my own, namely Claire as well, as I think someone pointed out the other week. But no, you know, hopefully, yeah, Wayne as well. Hopefully we can help provide some of that clarity on Thursday. We really hope so. Anyway, If not, feel free to come over and chat with me and Kate afterwards. But no, we think it's going to be a really, really fun session. So hopefully for the people that can join us, and hopefully it's some of you guys, it seems like it will be. So, but we are really, really looking forward to it. But without further ado, Kate, has there been anything in the news this week or anything this week that you want to talk about?
Yeah, actually, we have collected a couple of news, two of them that I will leave it for later because will be DPIA related, I think, very facial recognition. But actually, there is one that I would just like to pick to your brains because I think that we internally will definitely agree with this. So a new research by GRC Solutions suggests that many UK organizations are still struggling with basic GDPR compliance, even 8 hours, 80 years after the GDPR came into force. So apparently the biggest areas that they are struggling with are governance and accountability, risk management, handling data subject rights, and third parties.
Yeah.
Yes.
I guess I could see that.
I thought it was very interesting because it's definitely something that we can see here.
Yeah, maybe I could. I think I would resonate with that list for, I guess, companies with sort of lower data protection maturity as it stands. I think definitely on the cusp of accountability, I think you really find a lack of ownership in organizations who have less of a culture around data protection to actually sort of take it by the scruff of the neck and someone who wants to really, you know, attack it and to help bring other people on board as well. You know, especially with smaller companies, I've found there's a lot of conflict of interest, which is natural, you know, when you're looking at budgets or when you're looking at obviously the scope of staff and stuff like that, you know, whether it's CEO or the head of IT or HR and stuff. And, these can be really problematic situations to be in terms of the conflict. And, you know, I think it makes a lot of sense, really. And I'm not surprised. I think I'd really like to get underneath why, after 8 years, they still feel like it's problematic for them, whether it's the fact that they're not really giving it much of a go or that they're trying to, but they're coming towards like very obvious sort of like roadblocks. I don't know if probably SARS is a big one. You know, if you don't have the resource for as much as you want to try, if you don't have the resource in-house and you operate with a lot of data and you can't really afford to sort of outsource that option, then yeah, it's bound to be a little bit problematic, isn't it?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it's a mix of everything. I think it can be kind of arguable if it's like a budget problem, as well as a culture and awareness even, because I feel that, and we can see from a lot of customers of ours that we deal with them since, well, day one that we at least are here. So they are with us for a long period of time and we still see them struggling with certain areas of GDPR. Oh, that's why, obviously, because that's why we have a job. But we still see them struggling. And I think the main problems are budget-wise, culture, and actually normally the relevant stakeholders and even the boards and the big dogs of organizations actually do not care that much about GDPR. They still think that the option B is something that is not a law, is we will need to deal with compliance and governance and other legal issues, etc., outside for them at GDPR. And GDPR is just best practice and is incorrect, is not true. And I think the main ones are with this. And I feel that this article actually is very interesting because the main points about third parties is around the fact that they have found that suppliers of that organization per se have their poor access controls. They don't ever carry out any due diligence on people, on these organizations. No mention whatsoever to international transfers and if there are any kind of things on international transfers. And again, I think particularly when we are doing a work with ropers, isn't it? It's something that we do tend to ask. And normally the answer is, I have no idea. Yeah. No, I don't think so. No, we have nothing in place, I guess.
And how, yeah, I just wonder how, you know, you find yourself in that position to not even be aware, I guess, of the I think it's completely understandable to not have things in place. Mm-hmm. And, you know, by no means would I be saying that, you know, it is, you know, unjust for people to not have all of their compliance in order, because I think true compliance is so unbelievably difficult to actually achieve.
Yeah, I agree.
In any sort of case, it doesn't matter what kind of business you are, full compliance in any kind of respect is such a difficult job.
Yeah.
It really is. But I think just there seems to be an element of just not knowing just certain bits, like, what is a roper? You know, we'll tell you what a roper is, we can do this and that. You know what, I remember when the duo was sort of first popping about, when it first reached Royal Ascent, people were like, Oh, I heard you reference the doer. What, you know, what is that like? Can you tell me a little bit about that? And it's like, yeah, but of course, that's my job. Like, of course, I'm going to make sure that you're well informed. But we've already, like, we've been publishing stuff about this for months, really. You know, we've been
us and any other
and anybody else. Yeah,
it's like, you know, actually top of
have a little scroll on LinkedIn, and I'm sure you'll probably find somebody talking about it. But yeah, I mean, it's such a hard ask, and I don't think we can be too harsh on certain organizations,
yeah,
because sometimes people have other fish to fry. Sometimes it can be bigger fish, and it's just, you know, it's a hard ask, I think, at the moment.
I agree, and I think it was quite obvious. We had actually an internal meeting yesterday. We're talking about products and services, etc. And I think when we came to a point, we're talking about support, like the delivery side, consultancy, and support, I think the problem then was like, yes, this definitely, the organization should not be looked at the same level, because in the end of the day, GDPR is a risk-based approach, isn't it? So it's something that we need to look into, those type of organizations, natures, type of data, etc., and kind of modulate it as much as we can, in a sense of, for them to achieve compliance as much as possible. If there will ever be possible 100%, I don't think so. No. I think there'll be always some elements missing, or that needs to be updated, or it needs to be reviewed.
It can never be perfect with compliance. I don't think so anyway. I think there's always going to be something that you could probably be better at. But I think it's understanding within the scope and the risk of your business. If risk is obviously very topical for this session. If you believe that you're doing enough to actually cover the risks that come with the business, you know, I don't need a super in-depth regimented training program for my business if I only really operate with numbers and email, and you know, just because that is different from another organization, it doesn't mean one is more compliant than the other. It definitely can mean that. Don't get me wrong, it definitely can.
Yeah, but it just means
it just means that there's different risks for different businesses. Yeah. But you're trying to be as compliant as possible, I think, at the moment. I mean, full compliance. It depends how you define compliance, I guess, because it's ever changing.
Don't get me that philosophical definition now.
Okay, well, fair enough.
I think you are absolutely right. I think as well, we'll just go probably for another news, but I think it's important just to mention that we'll have actually a very interesting session in the future with a guest speaker about culture and awareness and the organization.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that this will be definitely, well, I'll mention it. Please, just to see what you feel. So, I've seen as well a couple of other news, actually, both of them, both related to facial recognition. And I would like to bring them here, because I feel that they will definitely be linked.
A nice little segue, isn't it?
I think. So the first one is related to the Metropolitan Police Service is facing a legal challenge over how it uses live facial recognition technology in public spaces. So the case was brought by the Big Brother Watch by two guys called Sean Thompson and Silky Kahlo. I'm sorry if I'm misspelling wrong. And the argument is not just that facial recognition is something bad, is something wrong. Mm. It's actually they're making the point that the rules at this very moment are just so broad, and the definitions and concepts are so broad and applicable to all the cases that are crime hotspots or access routes, or just double checking the definitions, and for safety and public purposes, etc. That is actually, it just cover all the public spaces, and that's the argument, because actually that arguably can be everywhere. So the argument they are making, the point, and they actually, the legal challenge is between what actually means by crime hotspots and safety, etc. That is actually a good, a legitimate interest per se, that's normally our kind of defense and argument. But we have as well the right to privacy and the European Convention on Human Rights. So this is both of the kind of one hand, the other hand.
I guess they argue this in the interest of the public, don't they? Obviously prevention and detection of crime and whatnot. You're right. I mean, it just seems like maybe a bit of a haphazard way to justify a position. And I think, on the point of risk, if we're stripping that down to sort of its bare necessities and we're looking at the principles, then, you know, crime hotspots, can we make sure that fits within purpose limitation, data minimization, the scope of what we're actually collecting this facial recognition on, what kind of crimes as well? It's all of, when we're looking at every kind of principle, I think it's all got a one one answer or another answer depending on how they actually respond to it as the police in terms of how they will roll it out.
Yeah.
It's not a case where you can, you know, if we're going to cover the broadness of sort of society with live rate facial recognition, I think it needs to be better defined than what it is now. I think that's probably the problem in the main. I just don't think it's been described enough with its actual intent and purpose.
Yeah, I know, I completely agree. I think the main problem here, actually, our boundaries, is the fact that we are kind of, because we have the definition that is so broad and kind of a little bit of everything can go inside of this definition, that for the safety purposes and making sure that people are confident in going to the streets and preventing of crime and et cetera, that we banalize the uses of facial recognitions and CCTVs and lives, et cetera, that are being installed everywhere. So I think, you know, that's actually interesting because that was something that I felt when I moved to the UK. We in Portugal, we actually, in principle, we do not allow the installation of these type of devices in streets, regardless if it's the crime area, et cetera, unless there is a very, very like well argument case and he needs to go for consultation process. And only after that, it will be probably installed and everyone is aware of it. And here in the UK is actually a matter of, we are in Leeds city center. You look to, I don't know, to some buildings and there are cameras everywhere.
Yeah, for sure.
Recording. So I think it's just, but kind of like everyone just have
a... I mean, half of them probably don't even work, to be honest.
Yeah, that's well, that's another point.
Yeah.
Like a false of, can be the opposite argument then, because it's the false of, say, like security, isn't it? Like positive.
Yeah. No, absolutely. It's definitely a really fair point. I do think, obviously, the thing you notice these things more when you look at things from like a practitioner perspective of like how much CCTV is actually sort of out there as you sort of going throughout your day. And, you know, sometimes maybe I think I'm a little bit sad. So I'm walking through town, I'm just like, you know, well, I wonder what your justification is, you know.
Being what?
You've done a legitimate interest assessment. Yeah, and sometimes I find myself shaking my head a little bit, but yeah, I don't know. There's another case, wasn't there, in relation
to the second one, that is the fact that the UK government has published a major policing reform plan, and the idea is to have fewer local police forces. So obviously AI is stealing our jobs, here we are, and then heavy reliance on AI and data-driven tools. So they want to include, for now, the first stage of the plan is to install 40 new mobile facial recognition vans that will be provided by the Home Office. And then if everything goes right, etc., actually they will open the scope and install more and more and more. And again, in terms of the same arguments, crime, prevention of crime, safety purposes, etc. And apparently there will not be able to have that human error that AI, like you are live and stuff.
Yeah, I don't know about the validity of that statement, that there'll be no error. So it's been a human error.
Yes.
Probably be artificial, though. But yeah, I mean, I still feel so uneasy about the use of sort of automated AI and automated systems and AI.
Yeah.
It just doesn't feel quite right to me just yet. And I appreciate we've got to move, irrespective of how I feel, we have to move with the times. And I don't think the government at the moment is moving quick enough with the times, as we can see from all the past weeks that we've been discussing this kind of thing.
I think with this case, actually, the main point as well, and I forgot to mention, sorry, is the fact that they are already starting to be installed without the consultation process to be over. It's still supposed to have like a consultation process and then, okay, well, let's see actually what are the outcomes. But now they just decided, you know what? We already probably know exactly what will be the outcome, so we'll just do it anyway.
Yeah, and that's worrying, you know. Realistically, that is people like the police that need to be setting an example for compliance, and then people that work so closely with the authorities and the government, they need to be demonstrating, you know, that they're meant to be looked at as role models, I suppose. So it would be they should act as such, you know. If it shouldn't be a one for the another approach.
And
yeah, you know, I'd be keen to keep my eye on that as it develops. But, you know, at the moment, my thoughts are pretty straight shooting, to be fair.
But then now, like going to our actually topic of the session, I think we have a lot to cover here. I think there is a lot to cover, but I think we should start from probably the basics, right? So actually, what is a DPIA? I think we should start from the beginning. What is a DPII?
Do you want a specific definition?
Oh, no. Like, made it easy for me.
No, whenever anybody asks me this question, and I never really get it asked that explicitly, but sometimes if I'm ever sort of describing what a DPIA is I tend to describe it as a tool for an organization to identify and mitigate any potential risks for processing, specifically processing that they believe has risks that need to be accounted for.
Yeah.
And we can, I could go into the specifics of Article 35 if I wanted, really. But I think, for me anyway, that I don't think the intent is on whether you meet the requirements for Article 35 or not, as much as that's really important 100%. If you do. Mm-hmm. But if you want to do a DPIA anyway, I don't think the element of checking if you need to do one is of like significant like weight. Mm-hmm. I think you need to know absolutely when you have to. But I also think there's like a, and we see it all the time, there's a lovely sort of middle ground where you probably should think about doing one as well. But I also think it's, I know you feel a certain kind of way, but I also think it's like a little bit problematic when you do them for like sort of the middle kind of areas. And then it sort of falls off teetering towards the end, towards we'll kind of do it for everything.
Yeah.
And then it kind of defeats the purpose of them.
Yeah. No, I completely agree with you. I think, I completely agree. I think there are definitely high-risk processing activities. That's no way that we can stay away from the DPIAs. The profiling, the health checks, CCTVs, etc., facial recognitions, as we spoke about, definitely we can stay away from them. But you are absolutely right. We do have a little bit of belt on weed. So people that don't do any of DPIAs and that they have struggled to complete them, and I think it's worth it to kind of talk a little bit about that. But as well, like the middle ground, as you're mentioning, that they just do it every single time there is something new going on, regardless if it's a new system, regardless if it's a new supplier, regardless if it's a new IT, changes, anything, migration of softwares, etc. They do it for everything. And I think is in one hand actually can be discussed as good, because in the sense they are actually aware of, okay, something is happening and I want to make sure that I assess all the risks.
Shows a good appetite for I think I was going to pose that question back to you. Is, do you think that's like a good culture thing, or do you think it's a bad culture thing?
I think when is actually a very good question. I think when you start to do them and we actually have the implementation of that culture, absolutely fine. People are aware, they know where the DPIA, they probably have in mind like what will be the triggers. But on the other hand, do we actually understand the risks that DPIA in specific poses? Do we address them, actually, or is actually a copy and paste of potentially previous DPIAs? We just copy and paste everything, and that's it.
Well, that's what I think.
Because,
I mean, I don't think anybody has the time to like complete DPIAs to the actual intent that they need to be made for if they're doing it for so many different things. I mean, it truly is something that needs such a detailed approach. And I mean, I'm seeing it more and more now of just like very generic sort of like, there is a risk that there could be a personal data breach, or there is a risk that security isn't secure enough. It's like, okay, but that's not very specific, is it?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, there's probably a risk of a personal data breach for everything. Yeah, I get your point of that being a risk, but no, we need to look at this process specifically. And why is this third party a risk? Why is this specific supplier a risk? Why is following this policy potentially a risk? Maybe the policy's out of date. Maybe it needs to be updated.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a risk in the scope of the camera. Maybe we don't have a floor plan. If it's for CCTV, say, maybe we don't have a floor plan for the CCTV yet. Why is that a risk?
Mm-hmm.
Because the potential risk that we're not complying with one of the principles.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Instead of these. And then they quite irk me, to be honest, like when I'm reviewing them from my perspective. And sometimes when I'm going for it, it's like, oh, you know, there's always a risk of a breach, or the risk information is sent to the wrong person. Yeah, great. But, and I'm glad that you're trying to factor in for that. But also, how are you going to, I actually want to know how actively you're going to prevent that, to be honest with you. Oh, there's a chance of human error. Oh, okay. Well, tell me how you're going to prevent human error.
I'm sure that they will. I don't know. I have a feeling that potentially they have access to a template where some risks, they have like risks potentially identified as generic to just have some lights or inspiration. But actually, and that happened very recently with a customer of mine, that they sent me a couple now, like more than five DPIAs. And actually, fair enough, there were different processing activities, but the risk assessment was exactly all the same. So it was a risk of, I do remember that, was it obviously an authorized access always, which don't get me wrong, I do understand and I definitely appreciate that is in there, but I am the opinion that should be an authorized access for that specific area. So for example, if we are installing, I don't know, or onboarding this new supplier, this new IT system that involves AI, etc., where are the data actually being stored, like there are any access controls. So specifically for that, definitely there is a risk of a data breach and authorized access, etc., but should be specific for that activity. And I feel that the risks very easily are just generic. And as you were mentioning, I think that's your point, is they completely fit the purpose because, I mean, it's a copy and paste. Yes, the DPIA is in place, yes. The process is being followed, yes. Is it effective? No, it's not effective.
I mean,
so you're missing
the tail end of it. Like, yeah, I think in completing it, like, because I understand why the risks probably aren't completed as well. And I think, because the matter of fact is, completing these are quite hard. They're quite difficult. And
I
definitely think for people with maybe like not as much experience in the space or not as much knowledge, like that can be quite a difficult task because, you know, first of all, what is risk? Risk is such a difficult thing to define. And then now we're peeling it back to, okay, look at all these. You got to be really well-rounded to have such a good idea of like all the potential risks of a process. And I think when you're completing them in the main, you kind of already get a gist of risks. If I'm completing a DPIA and I'm like, oh, actually, this isn't covered in the privacy notice. Okay, I'm going to make a note to update. I'll update the privacy notice, but I'm still factoring that in as a risk until it's done, until it's approved and out there. But I think a lot of people are probably going through the DPIA, identifying, oh, okay, maybe we don't have this, maybe we don't have that, and then actively doing it. And then the risks are more like, oh, okay, we've actually think we've covered everything now. What are the other risks? And, you know, maybe that's not always the case, and that's what they're just, it is just a superficial sort of like look at it. But I do think it does come down to an element of them being a little bit hard to do, like effectively.
I completely agree with you, but I think, and that's why I defend, and I'm sure that you are with me on this, that the DPI should not be completed by one single person. It should be a joint work. I think is normally the organizations tend to rely on someone that is dealing with data protection matters, being the privacy officer, the DPO itself, or normally HR person or someone like that. But I think it should be a joint like work, should be definitely a DPO, potentially even a legal person, depending again on the activity, IT for the cyber and IT challenges and issues. I think it should be a joint work, process owner normally. And I'm not saying that the DPIA, for obviously the sake of time, and actually is a lot of things to do, isn't it? But like to have the activity itself, the process owner. Because at the end of the day, the DPIA, yes, if are the questions hard, they are. I've seen, and I will share with you in the end of the session, a couple of get links around ICO guidance and actually the ICO template for a DPIA. And the questions are so generic, like nature of the process. And
I really don't like the ICO template.
Probably no understand those type of concepts, and sometimes it's hard to actually describe them.
For sure.
I can imagine for someone that never dealt with data protection before. So I think it's like, it's very hard. And I think it should be like a joint work of everyone involved in these situations. I think should be consideration for everyone. And because in the end of the day, you are talking about, tell me what is going on.
Yeah.
Literally that, what type of data, personal data or not, well, but personal data here, obviously, who he is involved with, how the things will happen, and what are your main risks? And this is what the DPIA is about.
Oh, for sure. And I think Shane raises a good point, which is something that I was going to bring up. And it's a conversation that me and Joe had quite a while ago, actually, on one of the podcasts about, there's a lady on LinkedIn who was basically saying that it is the DPO's job and legal right to complete all DPIAs. It's like, well, no, that's technically not true. That's not what the UK GDPR says at all. It says they must be able to assist with tasks like DPIAs. Yeah. But I think whilst what you're saying is perfectly right, Shane, and you're right, the DPO should be there from an advisory perspective. I imagine there's probably quite a few people in the chat today who are likely responsible for the majority of completing quite a large majority of the DPIAs that they're receiving. You know, whatever that comes down to, I imagine that's probably the case. But I think that does lead into it. The DPO's obviously job in DPIAs is crucial. it is really, really important because it's ensuring that we cover, obviously, all the risks in relation to GDPR. That's where we come in.
Absolutely.
But Kate's right. It needs to be such a collaborative effort in all the people that we're deploying. You know, there's so many people that probably go into the creation of a process or the introduction of something, and it's being able to make sure that that all...
I was just going to say that I think it's not just a couple of people. You've got the vendors as well. If you're proposing a project, a solution, and you have, like, especially like nurses and staff who haven't completed DPIAs, the vendors can usually give a lot of additional information and help some of the cybersecurity reviews as well. Absolutely. So it doesn't put too much ownership on the users to know everything, but then they can vet what the supply has provided, provide a legal basis, and learn from the situation. Otherwise, the IG professionals will end up completing everything, and then they'll be biased to the whole thing. So, and that's something that I commonly see. So a lot of people call us the DPIA people. They don't understand the risks or responsibilities, and actually, they appreciate it. It's like a breach. They should be involved with their mistake and try and fix it and repair everything, because they appreciate it. And I've seen a lot of great learning from things like that.
Yeah, that's great, and that's a really fantastic point, Michael. And it's I do think it is something that it seems like a lot of process owners seem to take quite good responsibility for, actually. And from what I've seen anyway, from obviously our sort of like looking through the glass, so to speak. But I do seem to see that the individuals do seem a little bit more like eager to help, or to identify. Oh, they probably need to do a DPIA. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think the DPO has to be from that perspective where they're holding hands, where they're working with them. But the vendor's point is a great point. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've seen this, Kate, but recently I've been seeing a lot of like vendor completed DPIAs like in full. And I don't know what your thoughts are on those in particular.
Yeah, I came across a couple of actually. I'm not very opposed to. I have my reservations, however. I think definitely they should help the controller to actually complete the DPIA.
Well, they're required to.
Exactly. Right? So they should doing that. However, I'm not sure. And I think where I kind of have my reservations are around the consultation process, and actually because the process activity itself is something that in principle is agreed in between both controller and process or suppliers, vendors, whatever. So it will be kind of straightforward, even if it's like completed by someone else. I'm happy with it because it will be the same lines for any type of documentation that will come from it. However, there are a couple of things that particularly around the consultation process. So internally on the vendor side, actually, what happened on their side for this to come up to be some sort of solution? And then on the controller side, what have you done? So, right, it's like...
Well, it's got to be a two-way street there, isn't it?
Yeah.
I have worked with people sort of recently who have just kind of took them and then just recorded them. It's like, oh yeah, but they're obviously going to know the flaws of their service. It's a very nice way to look at things, I suppose.
Yeah.
But not necessarily going to be super accurate. I think the information they're going to give you is like really, really important. You know, they're going to cover all the questions that you probably left lingering, you know, data center locations, accreditations, elements in relation to staff training, if they've got stuff like that, destruction processes. Mm-hmm. They've got all that really key information that's probably going to be really, really useful for the DPIA. But there is still so many other things to consider as the controller of the data that steps away from the fact that we have a processor that are also their obligations. So, you know, I think they're super helpful tools, and I'm glad the organizations are sort of taking that approach now, where they sort of, I think it's more to stop the questions for them asking to complete them, to be honest. It's better you complete one than complete loads all the time.
But that's why we have the as well the screening questionnaires, isn't it? Like the screening checklist to kind of help a little bit. Because I do think that data protection people's templates are obviously the best that we have in market. But anyway, I'm just going to double check the ICO ones, actually. And they, again, provide with a screening questionnaire in terms of things that people should consider, questions that actually, that normally I'm not the biggest fan of ICO actions, but on this, I need to kind of be on their side. So I think the guidance they provide in terms, particularly in terms of questions and practical cases scenarios, is very relatable to a person that normally does not tend to address data protection issues. So I think it's very relatable and easy to understand. And the screening questionnaires, I think it's a great, great thing to have implemented within your DPIA process to actually make that differentiation between, do we actually need a DPIA? Yes or no. How risk? Yes or no. Actually, or it's just recommended, because we have those cases, right? That is not required because it does not fulfill the Article 35 requirements. However, we definitely recommend.
Yeah, some stuff is nice to do for, isn't it?
It's in your mind that I do remember to do those a lot in like ROPAs. I do tend to do, and to like to do something, for example, around marketings, for example.
Yeah.
I do like to do something
certain elements of marketing. For sure. Sometimes I usually find like niche ways to link it to something somehow. So like,
yes.
usually I do them a lot with like charities and wealth screening, but that's usually comparing public sources, probably going to be invisible processing as well to a degree. Trying to think what else I see on the old daily.
Recommendations.
I see like migration of systems a lot.
Yes.
A lot, actually. Yes. And I understand it because there's a lot of data. Sometimes they say it's large scale processing. Don't necessarily. I don't know if I agree with that, to be honest with you.
On that, and now you said two magic words, large scale processing. So I think that that's a good concept, isn't it? Because actually, we don't have a definition. So actually, based on the fact that GDPR is a risk based approach, right? So I do see large scale processing as something, again, based on the nature of certain organization. What is like. You would say, what would you say that is acceptable as a large scale processing? Because actually I had that exactly question, exactly like this, in terms of distance for a costume of hours, and saying, well, do you process a lot of data, like in high volume, but would that be considered as a large scale of processing?
So
in terms of definition.
There's one way I look at it, which I think is like kind of restrictive, but I do say that if I think that you are typically processing something that is out of the norm for you as a business, that is not typical for you to process this kind of data, then I would make an argument that we could consider it large scale. Then you look at things like hospitals, even some schools, maybe some trusts who process so much data. Not if we take an example of a trust of schools, you know, say if you're one of those like big massive trusts with like, I don't know, like 30 schools in them, you also have, you know, you got the staff, you've got volunteers, you've got the students, you've probably got parents as well, you've got people related to the parents. But we've got people just outside of that in terms of people that may work with CPOMs or people that may work with SEN children. And that is really significant. It's quite a lot of data. Yeah, and maybe take the approach for some activities. If we're migrating a system like that, you know, say if we have a CPOMs-esque system that we're moving off from, that is a substantial amount of data in itself. So, you know, potentially it could fit that definition. But I think the great and horrible thing about data protection is that everything has its own justification. You know, it always depends. And I think if you want to make an argument something's large scale, then fine. But I think, you know, absolutely right, Kate. I think the screening checklist, if people aren't utilizing it, really should be, because I see so many DPIAs done for things. I'm just reading this. It's like, yeah, we. I appreciate you doing this, and I really like commend the attempt to cover the fact that you're complying with data protection. Just because you feel like there's elements of something that changes your approach to data protection because you're doing something, just doesn't mean that you always have to do a DPIA just because something's changing. You know, you'd still do the same stuff. You just don't need to document it necessarily in a DPIA.
But in certain cases like that, if not majority, I'm assuming, and within the procurement process, a risk assessment would be already, for example, already included within the process. So, for example, I guess situations like, shall I carry out like a DPIA? And when we come to a conclusion that, well, requirements Article 35 are not foreseen, and then actually is a low risk based on the nature of the data, etc., but then they still want to do. But we came then to a conclusion that you are duplicating your work, because I do appreciate that you actually want to address some risks, but those risks were already addressed when you, in this specific case, when you were doing the procurement and the due diligence, for example, to that supply in specific and onboarding. I think we can try to think about like a full picture. Mm. And instead of like, okay, call different names for everything, we can just do, okay, we're onboarding a client or this supplier or this new system, or we want to, and thinking about this, because I think that's a very important as well, just to highlight. This should always happen before it happens.
Definitely.
And we do come across cases that they're already implemented and they decide to have a DPIA for accountability purpose. But again, I think, again, they defeat a little bit of purpose, doesn't
it? Yeah. I mean, I guess it's a little bit difficult for a DPO. You know, imagine, you know, you've just joined a new company, took over from a prior DPO.
Of course.
Obviously, yeah. Probably one of the first things that you're going to go back on is have a look through retrospect. Maybe the first thing you do is have a look at the ROPA, have a look at the policy and procedures, and you're going, okay, there's probably some, you know, oh, guys, can I have a look at the DPIA for this?
Yeah.
What are you talking about? Oh, okay. No worries. I'll go away and do the shall I? And, you know, sometimes you find yourself in that sort of impossible situation where they have to be retrospective.
Yes.
Obviously, hopefully that wouldn't be the case, but it's only kind of as valuable as the point in time, I guess. Like, I think there is an important point and important. I think you also make I think you also make a good point in relation to the due diligence, because that is an essence a risk assessment.
Of course.
It's a risk assessment in itself. So if I'm doing a DPIA on a supplier, then I'm basically doing due diligence again.
Right? Yeah, it's part of actually what you're doing. So in the end of the day, you are duplicating work. But actually you made a good point on that. That is, and okay, so we are doing DPIAs after things already are happening, right? And what if we come to the point that there are risks that we cannot reduce? What the actually, well, law and actually ICO guidance says is, well, we need to consult to consult the ICO. We need to go to them and say, well, we do have this activity. It's considered high risk. We address all the risks, but unfortunately, we cannot reduce them. So what they say is, please don't do anything. Please pause it or just don't advance with anything and go to the ICO. But actually, that is already happening, right? Because we did the DPIA after the processing activity starts. Oh. So in those cases, I think it's very hard to manage, isn't it? Because in the end of the day, DPO again is definitely to advise and to recommend. Something is already happening. We are saying, well, this is definitely not appropriate. We have massive risks. We need to address this to potentially the ICO. Shall we stop? Or, for example, I don't know, completely for the sake of argument, but this AI tool, amazing for HR purposes.
And it's actually benefiting the business. It's always, and I think data protection always comes down to two parts is, you know, can you comply and is the business willing to accept
to
that?
Accept
you
it.
Know, and there's always going to be certain risks that come with elements, you know, whether it's with things like marketing, things like invisible processing, elements of data protection that you can't quite cover as well as you'd like to. But you still see value in whatever it is that you're trying to achieve. You know, it is ultimately always at the whim of whoever runs the business to make that decision.
Absolutely.
You know, as a DPO, you can fight tooth and nail over making things compliant.
Oh, my God knows how hard is this.
Yeah, I was going to say, we only see like half of the struggle sometimes. Yeah. If, you know, if a business is willing to accept a risk on something, what is also of paramount of importance is that you have something like a DPIA. Mm. You know, if push comes to shove and worse comes to worse and the ICO get involved, then you say, listen, we've done what we can as a business. This is how we've looked at the risk. This is how we've assessed the risk. We've notified you've done this. We've done that. As a business, we made the decision to proceed because of X, because of Y, because of Z. We put that in some kind of risk management tool. In terms of like business risk, we document it because that's probably the most important thing more than anything is that we've actually got hard evidence, as well as it's an amazing sort of exercise. The fact that it's documented is really quite necessary.
I mean, at the end of the day, if you do complete, like, for example, like if you complete DPIAs, you actually within the document itself, you do address the risks, right? But then it's just pointless because you don't do anything with them. It's not incorporated in the risk register. They are not mentioned or addressed to the relevant people. They don't do anything with them. So what was the point? You just waste your time in doing something that actually the main purpose is, okay, before we do something with this, let's see what are the risks associated with that. But then you don't do anything with the risk. So in the end, we just...
What's the point?
Yeah. So, I mean, save your time then, right?
Yeah. Well, a little bit mindful of time, just because I think we've been going late for nearly about an hour now.
Really?
Oh, that's what the recording's saying. Give or take. I think it's been more than 45.
We have complaints from our producer, five.
That's about.
But have you got any? We'll leave you with a question then.
Oh, lovely.
So what for you is a good DPIA? What are you looking for in a DPIA?
I'm looking for something that, first and foremost, especially from an outsource perspective, that is readable to the sense where I can actually immerse myself into the business and the project. If I don't understand fully what's going on in through all assets, there is really no real way that I can even go about assessing the risk. If I'm, I think I was looking at something the other day that it didn't even have a title. It didn't even describe the processing activity. It just kind of went straight into the nature and the context and the lawful basis and the data. Mm. And I'm like, oh, okay, cool. This means absolutely nothing to me because I don't know what you're talking about. So I think that's a big one, is clarity. It's got to be easy to read for everybody, not just for the business, but write it like you expect the ICO to come barging through your door, really. Secondly, the fact that is, I would say, collaborative, if I haven't already said that word, that we're working with, as people mentioned, we're working with vendors, we're working with process owners, we're working with any other relevant members, HR, and the DPO can give it that nice little bit of flash, that little bit of finish that makes it be what it needs to be. And then probably lastly and most importantly, a thorough account of the actual risks that are present and real meaningful ways to then mitigate them.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be any kind of risk. Risk is so fluid and it changes from all sorts of elements of processing. So I think it's really, really important that when we're doing these things, we're not just looking to put down the elements that we think comply with the principles. It's like, that's amazing. And I think it does a lot to help make it compliant. But we've really got to look deeply into the risk and, you know, in the likelihood of risk. You know, I don't think we want to be reaching too far, but really making a good effort to account for any risk and actively working on them as well. Not just being like, oh, okay, seems like their data centers are based in the UAE. No worries. We'll put that down as a risk.
Cheers, but
but it's like we need to see some kind of documented active follow-up as well.
Yeah,
you know, if that is a risk, put it somewhere else, pop it in the risk register, keep it in the DPIA, but maybe let's update the DPIA and say, actually, you know, we consider this risk to be completed now because as of this day, you know, go back to those DPIAs and prove that you've actually actively addressed those risks, because the ICO are probably asking the same thing. It's like, okay, so you've identified this transfer to the UAE. What did you do about it?
Yeah. After like a couple of months, like 6-7 months, whatever, already passed through, what you have done about them?
Sorry. You said a thing and my brain went very childish. Apologies, said 6-7. Apologies for anybody listening who got second-hand embarrassment from me laughing at a 6-7 joke. In 2026, but yeah, no. great point, Kate. A great point.
Sorry. Well, I think probably is on in our time, right? We are just like taking.
Yeah. No shame.
Shame
came on me.
But anyway, thank you very much, all of you. I would just like to, surely, if you are follow our LinkedIn page, you will probably have seen these work of art from Phil. He likes to do this type of things, and I think this is very appropriate for the moment. Sorry, I just like wrong camera. So this is, how do you call this in English?
A coaster.
This is a coaster. And this is a favorite, this is Kathy's phrase, isn't it? I can't say it because, well, it is what it is, but I'm sure you can read it. So
On this maybe note, so if anybody happens to be at the stairs event on Thursday, which, you know, again, we hope you are for the other time, it is very Samuel L. Jackson. Thank you, Charlotte. That's exactly what we thought as well. If you're going to be there, we're also going to be handing those out at the event as well. So if you do like the look of them, then make sure you go grab one of those or two, or maybe three if you're nice enough.
Oh, we do have one for every single topic, so please do.
we've got some fun ones. I think Phil really enjoys doing this kind of stuff. So we'll take them by popular request, really. If you want us to take an idea away and make it for you, then just ask Phil, because he'll be buzzing to do it, to be honest with you. Joel, well, if you are that gutted, then I would say, if I'm being particularly cheeky, if you drop us a message with maybe like an address we can contact you, maybe we can get one sent as well.
I thought you were about to ask some reviews.
No. That would be very cheeky, wouldn't it?
Miles will do it anyway, yeah, Jill. Sorry.
Yeah, Jill. If you want to get in contact and ask for one, I'm sure Miles wouldn't mind sending you one over. Is a reasonable enough man.
I think so.
I'm sure he'd be happy to do that. And that applies to anybody else as well. But of course, we want to thank you guys to listening to us ramble. once again on another Friday afternoon, and probably will be another session on it actually.
Like a more practical one.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah. Just because I think there's a few bits of news, won't there? But yeah, as always, thank you guys. We hope you have a lovely weekend, and we'd love to see you on Thursday for the folks that can make it. Yeah. I'm sure that you come and say hello.